Our man on the scene, Dave Poulin, in town to do the game last night on TSN television. Dave joins us this morning. As always, a presentation of the Myers Automotive Group. How are you doing this morning, Dave?
Very well, gentlemen. Just unraveling what I saw last night. There was some unraveling to do there, and particularly on that winning goal. And, you know, my first thought at the time was both teams had too many men on the ice, but they didn't. Actually, there were six Ottawa Senators on the ice at that point, and there were only five Buffalo Sabres. And it was Josh Brown who realized first that the whistle hadn't blown. And so it was his action of picking up the puck and coming up the ice that triggered like three guys to leave the pile, the Buffalo side of the pile. See, Buffalo's on the outside of that pile, on the ice side. Whereas because of where the pile was and the bench was, the Ottawa players are right by the door. So the first reaction of their three guys was to change. The first reaction of the Ottawa three guys was to turn and get back into the play. And then it was a strip from behind by Jankowski of Josh Brown that turns things the other way. Josh Brown thinks, I got a two-on-one here with Brady Tkachuk. So there's so many different things going on. Very surprised. We all thought the whistle had blown, guys, and we just did. I mean, you just assumed because there were refs pulling bodies out of a pot. When that happens, the whistle has usually gone. And for whatever reason, it didn't. And then proceeded from there, and Jankowski makes a good play to strip Josh Brown of the puck and goes in and scores. And I'm sure at that point, you can see, you know, Anton Forsberg's thinking, wait a second, is this for real right now? Or am I just, you know, is this the whistle blowing and we're in practice and I'm just saying, what are you still doing going? The coach blew the whistle. Mm. So crazy, crazy sequence. And I hadn't seen anything quite like it before. John Abbott, who I was doing the game with, felt the same way. He looked at me and said, have you ever seen anything like that? And I said, no, not in that exact context. And the oldest adage is to play until you hear the whistle, and a couple guys did, but it was actually Josh Brown who did first.
As you said, the anticipation was for a whistle that never happened. In your opinion, should it have been whistled down?
I think so. I think you've got bodies piled in like that. You know, you've got four or five or six guys piled in at that point. Usually when it's in that proximity to the bench and the door is open, they're trying to avoid something worse happening, you know, a melee of any sort happening. But I guess the accurate thing is if they think they can get it separated and they read it differently, because the pile was separating itself, JR, because of what happened. And the Buffalo guys were a little late in getting there originally. And then they were, as I said, on the inside, on the ice side. So I guess technically no, but expectation wise, yes.
Do you think in the case of Brown Pooley, for the role he plays, that one eye was actually on, should I jump into the scrum versus necessarily thinking about handling the puck?
Absolutely. In fact, I think when he first picked the puck up, it was to get back towards the scrum, not to handle the puck, because of the guys, and he'd be the most willing to go into that pile and clean things up. And so you had a little role reversal going on at that point. Certainly with Josh Brown.
Okay, so that was a talking point in the loss, because the game-winning goal ended up being scored on that whole play. The other was at the end of the game, and on the television broadcast, you appeared to be, and I won't put words in your mouth, a little bit perplexed by the decision by DJ Smith and company to either A, not call a timeout, or B, not pull the goalie, or both of them together on two different opportunities during that late power play. So kind of take us through your thinking on how that all played itself out.
Yeah, so mine started at the whistle blowing at the halfway point of the penalty. So the penalty happens, I look up, I see 3 minutes, and I want to get into a different aspect of this. And, you know, the beauty of being in the buildings and not calling them off too, because we've been forced to do, you know, on occasion here, is I can now look at the bench. And I look at the bench and immediately one of the coaches is approaching. I think it was Jack Capuano who was approaching DJ to chat right when the whistle blows. And so they're halfway through and they haven't been able to set up in the first half of that power play. So between the 3 and the 2 minute mark, they haven't been able to get entry. So a couple thoughts, guys. You have the ultimate confidence in that power play, who moved the puck very well last night, scored one goal, had some different looks. I thought they used the down low ice very well. So he's got the ultimate confidence in his number one power play right now. That's the start of it. And it's the management of that. Number two, and I want to go in a few different directions here. I had the opportunity to play golf on a fairly regular occasion with an NFL coaching staff. And we used to talk about these types of things, and they have a coach called a quality control coach. All he does is manage the clock during a game. Now, in the NFL, you have three timeouts, you have, you know, all these different situations, but all the quality control coach does, his only job, because they have way too many coaches in the NFL, is to manage the clock. And we talked about this, and they would say to me, well, who manages the clock? And I would say, well, you know, sometimes that's designated to an assistant coach, and, you know, the head coach has the ultimate call. But, you know, sometimes it's an assistant coach who goes up and pulls on his sleeve and says, hey, we're taking the timeout now. And he has that authority over the head coach just because that's his job, and that's part of his job description. And I'm not sure, you know, different coaches handle that in different ways. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how the Sens do handle that. But, you know, that might be a good question to follow up and say, you know, is there a guy specifically that, you know, how was the conversation? You know, it was had. And so then, you know, I'll take a step further. When I started coaching, early in my tenure, there was a general manager at one of my games, and I was with him afterwards, and he said to me, you called a timeout in the second period. And I said, well, yeah, I'm on the bench, and you know, I didn't like the way things were going, and I just wanted to rattle things, and I called a timeout. I was a rookie coach. I'd never coached before. And he smiled, and he said, I'll never challenge you for when you call a timeout. I'll talk to you about it. I'll get your thoughts about it, but I'll never challenge you because I'm not on the bench. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what the mood is. You're the head coach. You're going to read that mood. He said, but if the game ends and you still have a timeout left, and I think you should have called it at some point, then we're going to have a conversation. And that always stayed with me. And maybe it made me more aggressive to use a timeout during a game if I thought the timing was critical. So those are just some background things. And so now you're at the 2-minute mark, and your thought is you've got, you know, your number one power play is not effective in the first half. And you look up and you say, they can't go the whole 3 minutes, so I'm going to rest them right now. And that's just a coaching decision, an absolute coaching decision. And you might rest them and get 30 seconds. You might get a quick whistle. You have the ultimate confidence in them, but you're clearly thinking you're going to get them back out. But at that point, at the 2-minute point, I did say on air, I'm surprised that they're not calling them out right now and then having the opportunity to come back 6-on-4 with their number one power play group between the 2-minute and the 1-minute mark of the game.
And in that case, Pooley, you have to, both assistant coaches have been a head coach. Bobby Jones is the eye in the sky. I think he's hooked up to Capuano. Are you saying that you think they went through the protocol and decided not to, or you think they forgot?
I don't think they forgot. I think it was mentioned at some point. I do. I don't think, you know, it was someone's job to remind them, so they didn't forget. That's what I will say. Yeah. It's not, you know, they know the time of the game. Someone is responsible for that, and usually it's not the head coach. It's simply not, because he's got so many things on his plate. Who's up next? You know, how am I going to manage this? Now, some head coaches do like to handle that themselves, Simmer. But that should be a conversation that it is a conversation that is had. And I did see the coaches communicate at that point. I'm right across from the benches, and I looked and I saw the coaches communicate at that point. So it may have been, but once again, I think sometimes when you go through a situation like that, maybe now you change a definition. And you know, head coaches are always learning exact situations as well. And that might be a conversation where you said, okay, you can't give me a choice there. You have to tell me I am taking my time out there, not that should we take our time out there. And that may be, those are healthy conversations to have.
Yeah, oh no, I think everyone's always learning. I kind of looked at it, Pooley, and I've never coached, but I look at where Ottawa's at. I look at a game like last night, and I look at kind of a teaching moment in a sense of my group. Like, I would have, at the minute the power play comes, it's the middle of January, there's nobody in the building, two of the bottom teams in the NHL, wouldn't you say to your group, listen, time out, pull the goaltender, let's get Nick Paul on there as a bigger body. Let's go after these guys. They played yesterday. Like, in a review. I'm not saying last night, but as he could reconvene today, would that not be the discussion of, boy, we should be a little bolder here on our approach. We're not hinging on every point to try to make the playoffs at this point.
So you mean right at the 3-minute mark at the start?
Oh, absolutely. Like, let's get after them. Like, listen, time out. Let's go 6-on-4. Come on. Here's a challenge to you guys. This is all about the whole learning curve here.
Yes, yeah, and I think I'm fully comfortable with that. I'd also say Brady Tkachuk or Josh Norris, whichever one takes the draw, is going to win the draw. We're going to get control, and that's when we're going to do it. And so all I'm doing is taking exactly what you're saying and taking it past puck possession. And as soon as I have puck possession, the problem was in that first minute, they didn't get that puck possession. Yeah. And I think that's what DJ referred to after the game, is that was the plan, the exact plan that you just said, except they didn't get possession. And he trusted that they would because he believes in his power play, and they've had possession, you know, for a good portion of the evening on the power play. So I think that exact discussion did happen, Simmer.
Eric Branstrom certainly got on the radar screen for a lot of different reasons last night. The Okpozo hit you mentioned, physical side, the breakaway pass to Formanton on the, I think it was his first shift of the game, from his goal line all the way out to pretty much the opposing red line, like tape to tape. Lots of other different little subtle play. I think you had a little highlight pack of him after the first period. What are you now that you've had a chance to see him in person as well, not just watching things on TV, what did you make of Branstrom in particular and seeing him last night?
I like the growth of his game. I thought he was really good. He covers a lot of ground. He had a play when he was on the power play that we highlighted as well, where he was caught kind of in a two-on-one defending the power play. He went all the way to one side of the rink, then came all the way back against young Samuelson, Shel Samuelson's son, Matias Samuelson. Literally traversed the ice twice in the course of seconds. And so he's confident in doing that. He just looks more confident. And, you know, I get into these little golf analogies, and I talk about his long game with the Formanton pass, but he had some good short game passes as well last night, little 3-5 foot passes to the middle of the ice, through the defender's stick, behind the net, onto the tape of his partner. I think he put his partner in a good place, and I think that's a very underrated thing for a defenseman in the defensive zone, to always try and put your partner in a good place so he's receiving the pass and moving forward with it and not costing himself a stride. I think he did that pretty well. He had a pretty full box line score, physical. He actually led the team in hits last night, and with a couple of other guys with four hits, and a little bit surprisingly physical against Okposo there, which caught them. Okposo's a big kid. And caught them there. And there's still going to be a risk-reward with Eric Branstrom, I believe, in terms of until he finds a line of exactly what he can and can't do. And when a young defenseman comes into the league, he's pretty much, you know, if you look at Eric Branstrom playing at the junior level in Sweden or even in the men's league as a young player, he's got a pretty green light. And that's what makes him a good player. And, guys, I watched it last night, you know, just switching gears a little bit here, Thomas Chabot is so good. And you're just watching the growth in his game. And there were points, you know, 3 years ago when you'd say, what are you doing? And now you're looking at him saying, man, is he a good player. Like, he is just a really, really good hockey player. And he puts himself in less high-risk situations, but he's in full control. I mean, he's so confident in his ability to step up. You know, and it's easy to say because he's a couple of years older. And, you know, that's just what happens with a young defenseman. If you don't give him a little bit of leeway early, you don't get the results later. And it's such a fine line in development. I think that's where they're at with Eric Branstrom.
Yeah, so back to Branstrom for a second. He's listed, Dave, at 5'9". Everybody I know who's seen him in person says he's not 5'9". Like, he's probably closer to 5'7" than 5'9". And we know that this particular coaching staff, and even the manager, they like a lot of hockey coaches, right? They like defensemen. They like the tall trees. We saw Montreal play itself out for Montreal. So I guess my question for you is more philosophical than anything. Can you play and win a Stanley Cup with a defenseman that is as physically small as Eric Branstrom is?
Yes, you can. And you can do it by the makeup of the rest of the group. I don't think you can have two of them or three of them in the lineup, but you can have one. And, you know, if he's got elite skills and brings different elements to the game and can move the puck up ice and can play a role in the power play and can do a lot of other things, you can absolutely have one. But I don't think you can have multiples in the lineup. And, you know, also, you know, he's got a different sort of challenge in that he plays the same side as Thomas Chabot. So Thomas Chabot is going to eat up 27, 28, 29 minutes. And so now you're going to get minutes, and there will be people that will stay away from Shabbat as well with their top line, you know, if you're on the road, so you get a matchup situation. So now he ends up with matchups. If he's the two or even the three on the left side, he ends up with matchups because people are staying away from Shabbat. And so that's a little bit of a different challenge for him, but I do think you can win with one of that type of defenseman in the lineup, yes.
Do you think Josh Brown should be a full-time NHL player?
I think that's still a transition. I just do. I don't think this defense is complete by any means, Simmer. And I think, you know, in many ways, he's filled a need for this team. And that need is going to change as this team grows. And that's just, you know, you've still got a couple of young defensemen in Alassie Thompson or Jake Sanderson that you think are going to come in and push that. And that's going to happen organically, if you will. That's going to happen in the proper time when it's ready to happen. So I don't think you have to force that issue right now at the curve they're at.
So, Dave, you've been a player. You've been a coach. You've worked in management. And now you're working on the media side of things. I'm interested to get your opinion on what went down in Edmonton yesterday between Jim Matheson, the reporter, and Leon Draisaitl.
Yeah, I don't know Leon Draisaitl personally. You know, I've had occasion over the years, over the many years of dealing with Edmonton, to deal with, you know, Jim Matheson, and, you know, he's a veteran writer. And it's unfortunate. It also speaks to the times where over the last couple of years, there's been no face-to-face interaction between these people. There simply hasn't. And I think relationships grow. There's a tremendous, tremendous amount of frustration in Edmonton right now on all sides. And, you know, the fans are frustrated. The media is covering the team, you know, is saying, well, this isn't what it was supposed to be. And they're starting to ask the challenging questions because it wasn't what it was supposed to be. You've got two of the best players in the world. You made some decisions over the summer to make that group better. It hasn't worked. And so, you know, I'm fine with the first two questions. And after that, at that point in a forum like that, I'd probably let it go. If I'm asking the questions and I try and address the player one-on-one later, the problem is you can't address the player one-on-one later now, JR. You can't sit with him in the locker room 45 minutes after practice and say, you know, what's going on? What do you think? We don't have that option. And, you know, it's Zoom calls and you're part of a group, or if you're at the rink and you're fortunate enough, you know, to be in a province where there are people and you're allowed to be in the same room, it's a very formal setting. The player's up at the dais. You're not, you know, and so that part of it is unfortunate, because over the years I was covered by some excellent writers. Did I always agree with them? Absolutely not. Did we iron things out? Yes, we did, because we sat like grown-ups in a room beside each other and ironed them out. And, you know, it's a piece of what we're dealing with right now in terms of media, and media player relations have changed drastically over the years. You know, when you had beat writers that you knew so personally and got to know so well over the years, guys like Jay Greenberg or Al Morganti or Boston, had a great group of guys like Kevin Paul DuPont and, you know, the departed Stephen Harris, and the guys that you could just trust and you knew, and that's not the way it is now. It's simply not. And social media is a platform now that takes that piece of it to a different level. I think it speaks as much to the frustration level of a superstar who's one of the best players in the world, who's looking around saying, you know, we're 2-10-2 in our last 14 games. This is terrible. And, you know, I'm taking the brunt of the questions, and I want a player to show emotion. I also want him to be in control. You know, there's so many different factors here, and it's unfortunate to watch it play out, but I think it speaks to the frustration level of everyone in Edmonton right now.
Is it also, Pooley, just a complete shift? We were discussing this off the air, where the print media and the voice they had, the platform, and I won't say this particular case, but there's got to be a lot of situations now where the players don't even necessarily look at the paper or have any idea who's writing on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's probably a little different on this one just because of the two people that were involved, Simmer, but yeah, I mean, if you try and absorb everything that's written about everything, you've got no chance. You know, there's a lot of voiceless, you know, or voiceful, faceless people out there that can you can put anything out there on social media, and it, you know, it can carry whatever weight it does. That is a part of it, this is a little different case. This is a veteran beat writer who's been around a long time and a superstar in the National Hockey League. So what you don't know, what people are going to be digging into today, okay, what history do these two have? What has Matheson written about Leon in the past that Leon did or didn't like, or, you know, that's what people will be digging up today.
Last one for you. The NHL has announced that after the All-Star break, they're no longer going to be testing players, as they have been on a daily basis for the past month plus, who are asymptomatic, unless it involves crossing the border, etc. Do you think that's the right decision?
I do think that's the right decision. You know, I've talked to so many different people in so many different fields about this, and, you know, even to go into the studio, we test ahead of going into the studio. And like, I'm perfectly healthy, I'm totally fine, but I'll test. And, you know, and so, boy, there's no right or wrong answers. You try and be safe right now. And, you know, I do think the way it's going across the board that you know, testing fully healthy players with no symptoms, we're past that stage now.
Yeah, I think the figure is that at least 70% of the players have already been on the COVID list,
right,
of the 700-odd players in the NHL, at least 70%.
Well, you're getting to be in a minority if you haven't been.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
you really
exactly
are, you know, across the way.
So Dave Poulin has a full off day today in Ottawa, because you're going to, as far as I know, I think you're staying in town, right, to call the Columbus game, the Pittsburgh game tomorrow night here in Ottawa. So are you doing the canal? Like, what's the plan? Anything good?
I will be breaking speed records on that canal today at some point.
Nice.
Absolutely. It may go end-to-end on it. How far can I go? What's the limit?
7.8 kilometers from one end to the other. So if you're going downtown and back, because I'm assuming you're at the Westin, you're doing like a full like 15K. You got it in you?
I didn't bring my own skates because I only had a carry-on bag, and that may be a factor, JR.
Okay, all right. All right. You'll give us a full report when we talk to you again on Friday.
Absolutely. Have a great day, guys.
You too. Thanks, Dave.